Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. Tonight, it's the first in our series of episodes bringing you The Spokesman Review's Summer Stories short fiction series. Now in its seventh year, Summer Stories is a special section in the Sunday Spokesman Review newspaper, featuring original short fiction by local authors on a common theme. This year's theme is Mount St. Helens, which erupted 40 years ago this year, on May 18th, 1980. Our first story is from Sean Vestal, a columnist for the Spokesman Review and award-winning fiction writer. His debut story collection, Godforsaken Idaho, won the Penn Bingham Prize, and his first novel, Daredevils, won the Washington State Book Award for Fiction. Here's Spokane Public Radio's Brian Lindsay reading Sean Vestal's story, The Thick Darkness.
The Thick Darkness by Sean Vestal. 1. It came as Father said it would come, a shroud over the sun, a night in the day, a black pall upon the earthly coffin of the wicked. 2. At the campground, the Forest Service man came and asked for $16. "Don't my taxes already run this place?" Father asked, but the Forest Service man told him it was still $8 a night for each campsite, and our large canvas tent was taking up two of them. "You could get a motel for $16," Father said. The Forest Service man listened patiently as Father discussed the failings and offenses of the government. Mother watched from the tent flap door, holding Ruth against her cocked hip. Food crates and the 50-gallon water tank filled one picnic table. David and Janine played Bible Go Fish at the other. The Forest Service man said, "That all may be true, Mr. Constant, but I'm still going to need $16 for the night." Father paid it. The following morning, we felt the earth tremble beneath our feet, a thrill and a fright. Father began watching the mountain through his binoculars. 3. We were seven, we Constants, Father and Mother and Joel and Janine and David and Ruth and me, Peter, the middle boy. We prayed kneeling in the mornings upon arising. We prayed before eating breakfast around the fire. We prayed over our lunches in the forests where we foraged, and we prayed over dinner. And we prayed together a final time each day, on our knees beside the hushing river, before climbing inside the tent for the night, prayed to be taken in the hands of the Lord and uplifted. 4. Father paid for the first day, but not the second or third. The earth shook again in the afternoon of the third day, a brief rumbling underfoot, the pines shaking. Father watched the mountain. Steam vented below the peak on the north side. He showed us through the binoculars. Another time he shouted for us to come and see. A blue gas was flowing upward from the mountain. He said the mountain itself was bulging. Its very shape and nature was changing. And who was it who could change the very shape and nature of the world? That night he read to us from Exodus, read of Moses and the stone tablets written by the finger of the Lord. When the forest man returned, it wasn't to ask for money, it was to tell us we had to leave. The volcano was going to erupt. The earth shook under our feet, even as he told us. "What if we choose to stay?" Father asked him. "You can't stay, sir," the Forest Service man said. "You don't have a choice." 5. Father brought us here to this forest and this river from Bliss, Idaho, where we had moved from Boise after he quit his job at his brother's machine shop, his brother's wickedness finally having become intolerable. Mother said he was proud, but Father said he knew his value. He said too many men had spent their righteousness in submission. Mother surprised us and said, "Your family going hungry won't be counted for much." Father warned her not to try his patience, and Mother asked how did he dare to call his stubbornness righteousness, and Father threw forth his hand, making a sound that would never leave the household. He spent the rest of the night pleading and apologizing to Mother. In Bliss, we rented a home with one bedroom and a sloping linoleum-floored kitchen. Mother taught us at home, Father worked at a dairy in Gooding until he lost that job, and worked at the truck stop in Mountain Home until he lost that job, and worked at the lumber yard in Jerome until the manager asked him to stop listening to preachers on the yard radio, and Father quit. "The world hates a free man," he said. 6. We broke down the tent and loaded the Wagoneer and the trailer. Father drove out of the campground, waving amiably at the Forest Service man as we left, and away from the shadow of the great mountain. Mother sang hymns, and some of us sang along. After winding westward for several miles, Father turned onto a dirt road and doubled back, and we were soon traveling east again, back toward the shadow of the mountain. Father stopped on the roadside, and we prayed that the Lord would lead us to where we were meant to be, and we drove along narrow logging roads with soft gravel shoulders until we found a meadow along the Green River where a line of tall, thin firs stood sentry along a grassy bank. "There is always a choice," Father said, as if to himself, as he parked the Wagoneer. 7. We were scared, mostly. Sometimes we were scared of Father. Sometimes we were scared because we were so unlike everyone else and feared we were in the wrong. Sometimes we were scared the world was ending and we were not righteous enough to be saved. Scared that we would stand on the burning earth and watch our mother and father lifted to the heavens. Mostly we were scared because our days had become so strange compared to those that came before, earth shaking without warning and mountains changing shape before our eyes. 8. Mother taught us how to gather beans from lupins and rinse them in the river to prevent poisoning. She taught us how to find oyster mushrooms on fallen alders, though it wasn't the best time for them yet, and she warned us away from bark mushrooms. Father went out to poach an elk, but came back with a creel of dappled trout and gigged frogs. We didn't have a fire. The days were cool and fine. We could smell the grass shoots and new buds of spring on the breeze. If Father thought he heard a car, he rushed us into the tent until he had glassed the valley with his binoculars and made sure no one was coming. 9. The mountain was farther away now, but still Father watched it. The tremors came regularly. The bulge on the slope was growing. He said you could see it. He said the Lord would protect us. He read to us from Exodus as we ate the bitter lupin beans. And all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, Speak thou with us, and we will hear. But let not God speak with us, lest we die. And Moses said unto the people, Fear not, for God is come to prove you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not. And the people stood afar off, and Moses drew near unto the thick darkness where God was. 10. When we heard the voice of the Lord at last, Father said, it would not appear as a human voice speaking words. We could not know or even imagine how it would manifest, he said, though if we were righteous, we would recognize it because it would be meant for us. He told us the end of the world might seem like something to fear, and it would indeed be fearsome to behold, but for the righteous, it would be the beginning of a glorious, never-ending new day. Father tuned in the ham radio and listened to the reports. He pored over the map and looked through the binoculars. Mother approached him repeatedly, speaking in such a low voice that we could not hear her words, but we could hear Father's answers. He said, We will not return there, Mother. We will never do it. He said, I believe we are protected here. He said, We need not fear the manifestations of the Lord. 11. We had finished breakfast and were cleaning the dishes in the river when it began. The world blurred and rumbled, hard enough to knock you sideways, loud enough to swallow all sound. The alders swished and flapped, and a cut bank on the river crumbled into the water. Father shouted as he looked through his binoculars, but we couldn't make out the words. A growl rose from the mountain, from under us, from all around, as if a giant awakening to anger, as of ancient malevolent machinery groaning back to life. An explosive crack came from the mountain, and we could not believe what we seemed to be seeing, the mountain crumbling to pieces and rushing toward us, the trees bent as if before a great wind, the stones began to skitter past us like small creatures fleeing a storm, and then from the crown, the curling, thick pillar of gray and black. This realm was disintegrating, preparing to reveal whatever lay behind it. Father kept the binoculars to his eyes and hollered soundlessly. Mother waved at us to go to the Wagoneer. An ashy flow arrived and moved about our feet, deepening. Mother dragged Ruth and David to the back of the wagon. Joel rushed to grab the water tank and stumbled with it to the wagon as the earth flowed around his ankles. A tree flashed past like a bullet, caroming end over end across the river, and then another skidded past. Janine ran to me where I sat, stunned, on the felled log with my pocket knife and stick. She took me by the hand and pulled me toward the Wagoneer. Mother shouted twice for Father, but he didn't turn. She climbed into the driver's seat and started the engine. 12. Inside, we could hear the earth shifting under us, shuffling, flowing, rising like a river and flowing toward the valley before us. We coughed in the dimming air, wiped our leaking eyes. Mom put the Wagoneer into gear, and the back door opened, and Father leapt in, shouting, "We'll be crushed!" Mother pressed the gas, and we leapt forward. She drove, lurching and bouncing and following the direction in which all things were flowing, but the earthy slurry was rising, a gray river flowing toward the green river, and soon it seized the wagon and stopped us. She started it again and continued, but still the ground raced past us, around us, and the engine seized again. Father shouted again, "We'll be crushed!" 13. Above us rose a black column of smoke. Behind us came the moving earth, the flying, fallen forest, and up ahead, somehow, under a canopy of advancing darkness, was the calm blue of a spring morning. Ruth wailed. Father coughed and coughed and spat. David panicked, shouted that we had to get out, but he pushed futilely at his door. A tree riding on the ashy flow crashed into the back window and spun off, cracking it open. The flowing earth sifted in smelling of fire. Then we began to move, just a bit, a tiny shift, but then it happened again, and soon we were taken up by the muddy flow, flocked and nudged on all sides by the fallen forest. We watched the ashen flow enter the river ahead of us, darkening the waters, and all things rose into one thing. All things came apart and reunited in a restless new alchemy of earth and water and rock and tree, and we rode it as the world dimmed and darkened. It was so fast. Father shouted and wept as we went, and Mother was silent and watchful, all of us wondering if this was salvation or mere reprieve, all of us flowing and weeping and coughing and praying. When we came to rest what seemed like hours later, filthy, alive, our battered Wagoneer atop a crash of trees in a world made of ash, watching the helicopter hovering above, we entered our new days of wonderment, the days and then the years of ceaseless wonder, each of us alone in it, each of us alone to answer whether the voice of the Lord was the disaster or the deliverance, or neither, or both.
You're listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. That was Brian Lindsay reading Sean Vessel's short story, The Thick Darkness, published as part of the Spokesman Review's 2020 Summer Stories short fiction series. Our next summer story, on this year's theme, Mount St. Helens, is by Beth Piatote. She is the author of the story collection, The Bead Workers, and an associate professor of Native American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, where she specializes in Native American literature, Nez Perce language and literature, Indigenous language revitalization, and creative writing. She is Nez Perce, enrolled with the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation. Rumblings by Beth Piatote. If it weren't for my daughter's fever, I might never have talked to Susanna. But we live in a world of rules, and the rule at preschool was no preschool if your kid has a fever. And that's where it started. This strange set of events. My wife, wrapped in her ruby robe, holding our daughter on her lap and handing me the thermometer. It was a Tuesday. I rinsed the thermometer and fetched the children's Tylenol. I held the baby and pressed a cold cloth to her flushed cheeks while my wife got dressed and poured herself a cup of coffee. She called in at work. Then, because the baby was sick and my wife would stay home, I didn't have to stop at the preschool on the way to the archive, which is how I got there early. And because I was early, I talked to Susanna. Susanna was neither a friend nor a stranger. We shared the intimacy of a long wooden table. For weeks, we had sat side by side, never speaking. It was a relationship of warm indifference. She never looked up when I arrived late, yet I felt her company every day. I only knew her name from the register and from hearing the archivist call her to retrieve paged items. Working in an archive suspends the rules of ordinary life. Under normal conditions, I would find it intolerable to sit in a wooden chair, folded over documents and writing with a pencil for 8 hours a day. But in the archive, we belonged to other worlds, like time travelers who had left ordinary life behind. We were loath to take breaks. One of our table mates, Jefferson, carbo-loaded at breakfast so he wouldn't have to stop to eat lunch. The rest of us slipped out to eat sandwiches from our lockers while standing in the hallway. Each afternoon, I left the archive with a light head and sore back, and a file full of notes on unbound paper. Each day, my timeline got fatter and the maps and stories more fleshed out. We were like vultures sinking into carrion, stripping and pecking the personal details of strangers from love letters, court records, documents, and diaries right down to the bone. At least, the best of us were like that. The best of us didn't talk to each other except in the hallway before the archive opened, which is where I was that morning. "You are early today," Susanna said. "It's purely by accident," I said. "You should be more careful," she said. Susanna had a slight German accent, which I began to hear more often after that. As I said, we barely stepped away from our work long enough to eat a sandwich, but as days progressed, we began to take that anxious ritual together. I told her about my research on the Minidoka internment camp in Idaho, and that I was reading the papers of a war relocation officer. She asked me how I became interested in Minidoka. I told her that when I was a boy, my grandfather said something curious. He said, "There used to be that place over there, as big as a city, but it's gone now. You can't find it on a map." Over time, I realized he was talking about the camp, at a place called Hunt, not far from where I grew up. When it was operating, it was the 8th largest city in the state. And then it was gone. "It's never gone," Susanna said. That seemed like a German thing to say, and I told her so. "Americans and Germans are different," I said. "Americans have made an art of forgetting catastrophe, not so the Germans." "Yes, from the state perspective, we have a policy to remember, to expose everything about the war," she said. "But our grandparents talk in riddles, too." Susanna was writing a dissertation on a 19th century British poet and clergyman named Gerald Manley Hopkins, whose papers were in the archive. She had a modest fellowship, which allowed her to rent a room in a house not far from Gonzaga. She said the cat who lived at the house had 6 toes. This was the extent of personal information I knew about Susanna. One day, while I was reading, she pressed her index finger on my elbow. "Can you help me?" she whispered. She pointed at a handwritten diary, at a word floating in smudged ink, making it hard to discern. I studied it closely, careful not to touch it, then whispered each letter. O-S-C-I-T-A-T-I-O-N. She wrote it on a piece of paper. "I don't know this word," she said, more to the paper than to me. I pointed at the door. She brought the paper to the hallway, where she read the quotation out loud. "I have never felt anything so touching, so contagious, so overwhelming as the spectacle at which I was yesterday present," she read. "Some 40 young throats breathing out their very hearts and lungs in loud, ecstatic, volcano-like yawning. The tears rose unbidden to my eyes, and I felt a lump and a yearning in my throat. It is not well in general to speak of one's own spiritual history, but here the glory reflects on others rather than oneself. I, too, had my moments of deep oscitation. Oh, what a wondrous, unspeakable relief is this method of oscitation." "It's yawning," I said. "To oscitate is to yawn." Then, without warning, I yawned. Then she yawned, too, because it happens that way sometimes, that you feel something coming and you can't quite control it. I told her I feared my auscultation was not as ecstatic and volcano-like as one might like, and she assured me it was perfectly adequate and quite fitting to the rules of the archive. I was mildly disappointed in her assessment. Adequate. Not many days after that, as we were eating lunch in the hallway, Susanna announced that it was her last day. "Tomorrow I am going to a funeral, and I return to Aachen on Saturday," she said. The first item hit me harder than the second. How could Susanna be going to a funeral? Who could she possibly know here? I asked her who had died. "I've never actually met her," Susanna said, "but I've been living in her house." "With the cat?" I asked. "Yes, you see," Susanna said, "I arranged everything with the owner by telephone, but she called me a few days before I came and told me that she had to go to the hospital for a routine matter. She asked me to feed her cat. She said it would only be a few days. But the woman's condition worsened with time. Susanna had asked to visit, but the woman insisted she was getting better, and she didn't want to meet Susanna for the first time looking so ill and not at all herself. In the meantime, a choir that the woman belonged to would meet at the house every Wednesday night to rehearse. As the woman got sicker, different members of her family came to stay so they could see her at the hospital. Susanna would come home from the archive some nights and hear the washing machine going, or see fresh eggs in the refrigerator or hair in the shower drain. She seldom saw the actual people, only evidence of their having passed through. Then the woman died. The choir showed up to practice songs for the funeral. The woman's parents came to select clothes for the burial. Susanna sorted the stack of mail. I realized that when Susanna went to the funeral, she would be seeing the woman for the first time. I asked if I could accompany her. It seemed too strange a thing to do alone, and I imagined that I was her only friend. Perhaps Susanna thought so too, because she agreed. The next morning, as I got dressed, I thought the strangest thing I would do that day was to go to the funeral of a woman I'd never met. But life can surprise you. I kissed my wife. I took the baby to preschool. I told myself it was a regular day, with only an unusual interlude, yet I felt a twinge as I drove past Boone Avenue, past the archive. Susanna was waiting in the foyer of the funeral home wearing a navy dress. It struck me I would never have seen her in a dress, were it not for this circumstance. I wondered about her other clothes I'd never seen. Her life suddenly became mysterious to me. We passed together through the receiving line, the family alternately dabbing their eyes and grasping our hands. A few seemed to know Susanna. It was odd how natural it felt to be there with her. The woman's name was Corrine. We arrived at the open casket and studied her still, gaunt face. Susanna drew a deep breath, and I lightly placed my hand on the small of her back. She seemed to relax then, and we walked together to the chapel. After the service, I offered to drive Susanna home. It was barely noon, and the sky was open and calm. We sat for a moment in the car. I felt unsure what to say. "Do you want to see the cat?" she asked. Indeed, I was curious to see the six-toed cat, although it hadn't been on my mind at that moment. I could see the big, smoky gray cat sitting in the front window looking out at us. I followed Susanna into the house. The cat had enormous paws, which suited his overall look as a large cat. He had the appearance of a dark cloud, but the personality of a sunbeam. He purred and rubbed his head under my hand. I asked what would become of him. Susanna said she didn't know exactly. Then, without warning, I moved toward Susanna. Or she moved toward me. I will never know who made the first move. But once it started, it did not stop. It was avalanche-like in its unfolding. We made our way to her room as a single animal, gliding, in my imagination, as ice skaters, but in reality more like an elk freeing a branch from its antlers. I was suffocating in the thought of death, of dust, and grasped after her to save me, to make me feel alive. The thing was, I didn't quite know where to put my hands. Legs, hips, back. I kept moving them around, never really committing to one, like a car wash. What was wrong with me? Perhaps it was the pressure of knowing this would be both the first and last time for us, a singular event that would divide the before from the after. I stayed with her for a while afterward. We didn't talk. Why would we? Her bags were packed and parked beside the bedroom door. The cat sat in the hallway and licked his giant paw. Eventually, I took a shower and said goodbye. The next day, Saturday, I drove past the house. Susanna was gone. I knew this. The cat, too, was missing from the sill. The house was but a shell, as though none of us had ever been there. The sky beyond was a reliable blue, with clouds of white gauze in the distance, and calla lilies slanted away from the porch. In the air was hardly a hint of the ruin that was already on its way. That was Rumblings by Beth Piatote, first published in the May 14th issue of the Spokesman Review as part of their annual Summer Stories short fiction series. This is The Bookshelf. Join us tomorrow evening for two more summer stories by Bruce Holbert and Joanna Stoberock. If you miss an episode or want to hear this episode again, you can find us at SpokanePublicRadio.org or look for The Bookshelf wherever you get your podcasts. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini.